Hi, I'm Misha Ketchell, editor of The Conversation. For democracy to work, people need to be well informed. That's why we work with academic experts to share their research and explain issues in the news. Everything we do is free to republish, but we need your support. Please donate to The Conversation by going to donate.theconversation.com or following the link in the show notes.
Hello, I'm Michelle Grattan and this is the Conversations Politics Podcast. We're talking today with Assistant Treasurer Josh Frydenberg as the issues of refugees and the Australia-China Free Trade Agreement have been dominating the political debate inside and outside Parliament. Josh Frydenberg, you were one of the early Liberals to call for a boost in the refugee intake to help with the Syrian crisis. What sort of feeling have you found in the community on this issue?
I think the community has expected us to do what we've done, which is to increase the size of our humanitarian intake, to allow for the people who are being persecuted in the Middle East, and particularly those people who have been displaced out of Syria, to find a safe haven in Australia. And the number announced today by the Prime Minister, an additional 12,000 places, is an extremely significant and generous and humane response to what is an urgent need.
The people being targeted are quite specific, aren't they? Women and children and families. Not many single males will get through the net here. Was that deliberate?
Well, also minorities.
Who have
been persecuted. And I think that reflects the fact that a number of these women are at risk who have been waiting in refugee camps, and a number of those minorities may never be able to get back to Syria. So we have a non-discriminatory policy, immigration policy in Australia, and I think that's a proud aspect of what has been a very successful policy over many decades. And the fact is, we're providing an additional 12,000 places to the people most in need, and that's the most important message from today.
You were strong on this issue early on, before a number of your colleagues. Is this an issue that's important to you?
Absolutely. And I know it's very important, Michelle, to a lot of my colleagues as well, and to hear their passionate comments in the party room when this issue was discussed twice, both today and earlier in the week, I think reflected the fact that they were hearing from their communities, that there was a need for the government to do more, as well as their own instincts, like mine, which was to help those desperate people fleeing the terrible ISIS regime.
There's been a lot of talk about how the picture of the toddler really touched people and led to a strong reaction. Have you found this in the people you've talked to?
Absolutely. And as a new father, it's something that really moved me. And I'm sure it moved everyone else. And you couldn't help but feel for the plight of these people when you saw that picture. And I know it went global. It was on the front page of newspapers right around the world. And I'm sure that has helped drive this this positive response we've seen in so many countries.
This is a one-off increase, but this crisis, of course, will be a long-extended one. Would you like to see this sort of generosity extended again in future years by the government?
Well, two points to make. The first is we have been taking larger numbers of people from the Syria and Iraq war zone over recent years. In fact, over the last year, we've taken 4,400 people from Syria and Iraq, which makes up nearly 30% of our special humanitarian program. Now, our special humanitarian program, as you know, is increasing from 13,750 today to 18,750 over the next few years. And I'm sure you will see a strong representation of people from the Middle East and Syria and Iraq in those numbers. So more will be done over time. But we have already been doing some significant things in this area, as well as providing more financial support. This additional announcement today of $44 million will bring to a total of $230 million the amount we've provided to deal with the Syrian and Iraqi humanitarian crisis in the last few years. So we're not only taking larger numbers of people here, but we're also providing more financial support to the agencies that are working on the ground, providing much needed food and shelter and clothing to those in need.
Now let me turn to your portfolio, which includes superannuation. The government has been insistent that industry funds should have a quota of independent directors. But why is this so important, given that these funds have been among the best performers?
Well, firstly, this is a recommendation that's come out of two major reports. The first was the Cooper Review, undertaken for the previous Labor government, the Gillard government. And there was then the Murray Review, which was undertaken for this Abbott government. Now, in the case of the Cooper Review, they recommended that a third of the directors be independent, and the Murray Review recommended that a majority of the directors be independent together with an independent chair. We have gone for a position in the middle of that, where a minimum one-third of directors will be independent together with an independent chair. We believe this will bring significant expertise to the boards, and the amount of money going into superannuation is significantly increasing over time. It's already $2 trillion, and Australia is the fourth country after the United States, after Japan, after the United Kingdom, with significant funds under management in superannuation. We have the fourth largest pool of funds under management. But with compulsory super going from 9.5% today to 12%, over time, this will mean that $2 trillion becomes $9 trillion. Now, if you are a nurse or a school teacher or another employee who with their life savings in super, you want the best people on those boards to make those determinations. Now, you're right, the industry funds have performed relatively well, but we think this reform will actually help them perform even better. And the fact is, the equal representation model, namely having half the representatives from employee groups and half from employer groups, was found by the Murray Inquiry not to be the reason, the causal connection, for the better returns of these industry funds. So this is not an ideological move. This is one that's based on sound evidence and the recommendations of independent inquiries. It also reflects the fact that a number of industry funds have already moved to a situation where they have an independent chair, or they have a minimum of one-third of their directors being independent. And this reform not just applies to industry funds, it also applies to retail funds and corporate funds. And so it's non-discriminatory in that respect.
You do a good deal of the heavy lifting in the general economic debate for the government. Yet we saw growth in the last quarter at a minimal level and an annual level of 2%. So you have a difficult story to sell. Do you think we are in for permanent low growth as a new normal, which was suggested by the Reserve Bank Governor Glenn Stevens, or can we look forward to a return to the 3% trend level of earlier years?
Well, you're right that the June quarter growth figures at 0.2% were below market expectations, which was 0.4%. But in the March quarter, Michelle, we had 0.9% GDP growth, which was above expectations from the market of 0.6%. And that was higher than we've seen across many of the G7 economies. Now, we are feeling the effects of the slowdown in China. It's our largest trading partner with $150 billion worth of two-way trade. We saw a 7% fall in mining exports over the last quarter, and that is something that the economy will have to absorb. But if you look at other resource-intensive economies like Canada and Brazil, they're actually technically in recession because they've had two consecutive quarters of economic growth. Now, Australia's in its 25th consecutive year of economic growth, only being surpassed by one other country, namely the Netherlands. And hopefully, if we continue with our growth story, we'll surpass them. And there are some very strong signs across the economy, whether it's in business confidence, whether it's in residential building approvals, whether it's in the 7% increase in the export of services in the last quarter. There are some positive signs, and that's why we're very serious about maintaining the momentum of the reform agenda, whether it's deregulation, whether it's the free trade agreements, whether it's tax reform, and whether it's infrastructure spending in the right places. If we do all those sort of things, Michelle, I think we will continue the very positive growth trajectory and that we see.
Back to the higher level?
Absolutely. We can get back to where the Reserve Bank has said is expected to be, the 2 to 3% range. But certainly the slowdown in China will be felt in economies like Australia. I mean, for example, Michelle, when we came to government, iron ore, which is our largest single export, was $120 per tonne. Today, it's around $50 per tonne. That's a significant drop, which really hits our budget bottom line.
Now, just taking up China and the free trade agreement, which has been a hot debate in recent weeks, the government has attacked Labor, which is saying that there are aspects that present a threat to jobs. The government's called Labor racist and very other unsavoury descriptions. But isn't there a risk that with high unemployment, above 6% unemployment, this Labor argument will resonate with quite a few voters, and especially voters in the Canning by-election?
I don't think it will, because people understand that as an economy of 23 million people, it's certainly in our interests to do a deal with an economy of 1.2 billion people where 95% of our exports will be tariff-free over the life of this agreement.
But Labor says that too. But it agrees with the deal in broad terms. It just says it needs more protections.
Well, that's just a motherhood statement from them, because unless they agree to the passage of this deal through the Parliament, then all their pious words when they're in government and now in opposition about wanting to strengthen relations with China will amount to nothing, because this deal can't, and the text of it can't, be reopened. And it is the first free trade agreement China has done with a G20 country, which is very significant. And if you look, for example, across the Tasman, New Zealand have seen a significant boost to their exports since they entered into a free trade agreement with China in 2008. And our wine producers and our dairy farmers have been significantly disadvantaged vis-a-vis their New Zealand counterparts because we haven't had that free trade agreement. Now, I'm particularly interested in the financial services space. It's an area that I'm responsible for. And whether it's insurance, whether it's in banking, whether it's in funds management, we'll see the liberalisation of rules there, which will be very beneficial to the export of services. So I'm excited about this deal. But the question needs to be asked, who is Bill Shorten acting for when he opposes this deal? It's certainly not the national interest. And that is why significant Labor luminaries like Bob Hawke and Simon Crean and Martin Ferguson and the state Labor premiers of Queensland, South Australia and Victoria have all come out positively support this deal. So he's really doing the bidding of the union movement, and particularly the CFMEU, who have run an expensive campaign against this deal. And it's time that he shed those union loyalties and acted in the national interest commensurate with his responsibility as a leader of a major political party.
Now, I mentioned the by-election. How important do you think this result, whatever it is, will be to both sides?
Well, it's certainly very important, and both sides have been running very hard in this campaign. Don't believe And the stories that the Labor Party is running dead, they're certainly not.
Well, that was said in Cabinet, I think.
Well, I wasn't in Cabinet.
No,
and neither were you, Michelle. So we can all rely on what we learn on television. But I think that our candidate there, Andrew Hastie, will be warmly received by the voters come September the 19th. It is an important by-election, but as you know, as a great student of politics, incumbent governments tend to suffer major swings in by-elections, at least on an average of 5%. And that's compounded by the fact that Don Randall had won 5 elections in Canning, was a much-loved local member, and I think those factors make this by-election difficult for us, but I am very hopeful that we'll win.
Assuming you win with a big swing, though, the government's been somewhat unsettled recently. We've had a lot of argy-bargy right at the top at cabinet level. Do you think a big swing in Canning, 9-10%, but you still retain the seat, would make it more unsettled, unhappy, difficult to manage?
Michelle, I think a win's a win. I think we'll all be very pleased when this is over and we can get on with the rest of the agenda. But certainly, I think Andrew Hastie is an outstanding candidate, and I think he'll win.
Now, a long way from Canning and Western Australia, you come from Victoria. Indeed, your seat of Kooyong was once occupied by Robert Menzies. These days, Victoria is very difficult ground for the Liberals. Why are they more unpopular there than, say, in New South Wales or Queensland?
Well, that's a very complex question, which I'm not sure I have an answer for it. And by the way, I wouldn't want to compare us to what's happening in New South Wales and Queensland, because it does fluctuate in those states too. I think what is particular about Victoria is it's traditionally had a very strong industrial base. A lot of manufacturing has been done in Victoria, and the unions have seen Victoria as their spiritual home. And so they're very active as a political force there. And I think that is an issue when it comes to fighting campaigns. And certainly at the last Victorian state election, we saw the unions out in every polling booth involved in very spirited campaigns against the government, whether it's around ambulance pay and a whole lot of other issues that were unresolved at the time of the last election. So I think you're right, Victoria is a battleground. It is difficult for the coalition. That being said, the Liberals have a very proud tradition in Victoria, and those marginal seats that we hold today, Corangamite, Deakin, Latrobe, Dunkley, I think we will do everything possible to hold on to them at the next election, and I'm confident that we will.
One of the problems, of course, is that usually there's a Victorian or more than one in the top ranks of the federal leadership, and they're absent.
Well, I would dispute that. Andrew Robb has done such a wonderful job with the free trade agreements as a high-profile member and successful one of this government. Greg Hunt has done brilliantly as the environment minister, has fought the campaign on the carbon tax and brought into legislation the Green Army, the Emissions Reduction Fund, and obviously internationally succeeded on the Barrier Reef issue. So he's done a lot. Kevin Andrews is the defence minister of this country at a time when we have our men and women in uniform deployed overseas. And then, of course, Bruce Bilson has been evangelical as the small business minister. They're just the cabinet ministers, and then Michael Ronaldson in the centenary of Anzac celebrations as the Minister for Veterans Affairs, Mitch Fifield dealing with the NDIS issue, myself as Assistant Treasurer. There are a lot, and then, of course, we've got parliamentary secretaries as well and prominent backbenchers. So the Victorian division is strong, but we still have work to do if we're going to retain those seats that are marginal at the next election and hopefully win some from the Labor Party, which, like Chisholm, should really be a Liberal-held seat.
Josh Frydenberg, thank you very much for talking with us today. And that's all for our podcast for this week. Thank you to my producer, Matt Dawson. We'll be back with another interview quite soon.
I was saved by God to make America great again.
An autocrat loves a crisis. A crisis is the way that they mobilize their base.
While America is under invasion from within, we're under invasion from within.
He's testing the boundaries of what he can get away with.
We should use some of these dangerous cities as training grounds for our military, National Guard, but military.
We've asked six of the world's preeminent scholars how we can measure the make of an autocrat. It's a recipe of sorts, tried and tested by the most infamous leaders in history.
Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Vladimir Putin in Russia.
Joseph Stalin and Adolf Hitler.
Viktor Orban in Hungary.
He's basically bulletproof in terms of criminal prosecution.
Join us from December 29 as we explore Trump, the making of an autocrat, from The Conversation.